Were the New Left movements of the 1960s and 70s an incomplete revolution?
I think culturally, as I said earlier, and socially, the country is vastly different. We revolutionized America, our movement in the 60s and 70s, the women's movement, the anti-war movement, the civil rights movement, and so on. But we fell short of taking political power.
That's David Talbot. We spend the hour talking with him about the book he co-authored with his sister, Margaret Talbot, By the Light of Burning Dreams, The Triumphs and Tragedies of the Second American Revolution. That's on today's menu at Writer's Voice, in-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. The 1960s and 70s were a time of political and cultural upheaval. Those who took active part in the movements of the day were convinced that they would revolutionize America. They would bring about racial justice, end U.S. imperialism, unite the working class, and liberate women from their patriarchal chains. But half a century later, it's clear the struggle continues, and the threats against social and economic justice are only multiplying. So, was it all in vain? And what can we learn from the successes and failures of those movements? In By the Light of Burning Dreams, New York Times best-selling author David Talbot and New Yorker journalist Margaret Talbot illuminate America's second revolutionary generation in their gripping history of one of the most dynamic eras of the 20th century. Margaret and David Talbot reveal the epiphanies that galvanized these modern revolutionaries and created unexpected connections and alliances between individual movements and across race, class, and gender divides. David Talbot is a journalist, author, activist, and independent historian. He's the author of 6 books, including Brothers, The Hidden History of the Kennedy Years, and The Devil's Chessboard. His sister, Margaret Talbot, is a staff writer for The New Yorker magazine. Well, David Talbot, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Great to be here.
This is just a terrific read, this book, By the Light of Burning Dreams, The Triumph and Tragedies of the Second American Revolution. First of all, why do you call the New Left movement of the 60s the Second American Revolution?
Well, that was a matter of some dispute. Some critics took us to task for using that term. But to me, it was a revolution. Anyone who grew up in the 1950s in America knew how different a world we created in the 1960s and 70s, culturally and socially. And we wanted to show how encompassing that really was. In some ways, it was a realization of the founding fathers, and we're all fathers, original ideals for the country. But it included in the 1960s and 70s vast swaths of the population that were left out in the original American Revolution, i.e. women, Native Americans, African Americans, working people, you know, most of the country, frankly. So yes, in sort of envisioning a new America in the 1960s and 70s that included all these peoples, that took people forward towards equality, towards peace and freedom, which is what our vision was. Yes, it was definitely revolutionary.
Now, you wrote this book with your sister, Margaret Talbot. Tell us why the two of you decided to engage with this project of yours.
Well, yeah, I was a foot soldier in the movement. I was at Santa Cruz in the late 60s, early 70s, UC Santa Cruz, a student. And even before then, I'd been kicked out of my military school in Los Angeles, the Harvard School, which was ROTC school at the time during the Vietnam War. So I was pretty radical myself. As I say, I wasn't a leader. I was too young to be that. But I did go to Black Panther rallies. I was involved in the prisoner rights movement, the Soledad Brothers, which was a prison near Santa Cruz. We went down there often. I was engaged, obviously, in a lot of anti-war activity and protests and demonstrations, got jailed, and so on. So this was my world. New left was my world as a young activist. Then, of course, history changed on us. Margaret, by the way, was too young to engage in it herself as an activist, but came up and stayed with us in our commune as a kid. So she saw this from a child's point of view and was always enchanted, I think, by what her older brother and sister, Cindy, my older sister, who's now a doctor in Portland, Oregon, was also very involved in radical politics at the time in Santa Cruz, and started, in fact, the first women's health clinic in Santa Cruz. Abortions and so on that weren't done before that in Santa Cruz. So I think for both Margaret and me, it was an attempt to understand this history that we'd lived through, me particularly, and understand why we fell short and what we did accomplish and what we didn't, how we were defeated. I think culturally, as I said earlier, and socially, the country is vastly different. We revolutionized America, our movement in the 60s and 70s, the women's movement, the anti-war movement, the civil rights movement, and so on. But we fell short of taking political power. And so instead of Bernie Sanders, for instance, as I point out in the book, we had Donald Trump. And even today, of course, we have a corporate elite that pretty much runs the country. We were fighting against those people, the power elite, during the 60s and 70s, and they won.
Yes, and they won.
They won politically.
And they won with a huge amount of repression and outright violence, which we'll go into. This book profiles key activists in the different parts of the New Left movement of the 1960s. You talk about Tom Hayden of the anti-war movement, Bobby Seale of the Black Panther Party, Cesar Chavez of the United Farm Workers, Russell Means and Dennis Banks of the American Indian Movement, AIM, and the Women of Jane, as well as others. Why this focus on individuals as opposed to the mass movements themselves?
Well, I know it's a little out of fashion these days, but Mark and I do believe in the value of strong and good and accountable leadership. And I don't think we would have succeeded to the extent we did succeed in the 60s and 70s without visionary, courageous leaders like Martin Luther King and many of the people that you mentioned. Now, yes, some of these people were deeply flawed. And Margaret and I were very honest, I think, as journalists, as historians, in recognizing their human frailties. And in some cases, like Huey Newton, who is the co-founder of the Black Panther Party with Bobby Seale, you know, he descended into drugs and gangsterism. And we chronicle that unflinchingly, I think, in the book. And so, yes, these leaders did have human flaws. Yes, they were probably not accountable enough to the movements which they led. We did learn from that. And yes, we didn't protect them enough, frankly. A number of them were assassinated. Others were jailed. They were decapitated in some ways, our movements, in the 1960s and 70s by, as you say, the government violence and police repression. These movements were heavily infiltrated by police and government informers. You mentioned Dennis Banks, who was the co-founder of the American Indian Movement. His bodyguard turned out to be an FBI agent. His wife, his ex-wife, was an informer for the government. There were thousands of people scattered throughout the American Indian Movement who were provocateurs, informers, and agents. And this was true of every radical movement in the 60s and 70s. The government knew that leaders mattered. We knew that leaders mattered. We didn't do a good enough job of protecting them or holding them accountable. But I don't think the lesson we take away from this history is that leaders are somehow not needed or are detrimental. I was at Occupy at Zuccotti Park the first weekend of that movement, and it was very horizontal, the structure. There was very anti-leader, the whole ethos. And I think that's a mistake. And that's why Occupy evaporated, frankly, and didn't continue to, I think, have an impact on American politics. It needed more structure and needed leadership.
Well, yes. I mean, I would agree with you in some sense, but I think it did have a huge impact because I actually don't think you would have gotten Bernie Sanders without Occupy. I mean, Occupy really brought... It was the first time in decades that critique of the capitalist system was claimed by the so-called 99%. You know, it broke that sense of loyalty, I think, to the oligarchy that so many people just reflexively had.
I think you're right. It changed the dialogue in this country, the political dialogue. And so in that respect, it of course had deep impact. But that, unfortunately, is the story of the left in America, at least during my lifetime, that the left has a big impact culturally, socially, on language and so on, and then evaporates because we don't have the discipline and the structure and I think the leadership that we need to make movements have a lasting impact. So when you compare Occupy, say, with the Tea Party got people elected to Congress. Yes, Bernie Sanders in some ways was a reflection of the Occupy kind of values, but he wasn't directly related to that movement. Tea Party got people who were part of that movement elected to Congress, had a big impact on the Republican Party and turning this country further to the right and leading to Donald Trump. And that still is a major problem for this country. So I think the left needs to get its act together. That's frankly one of the lessons of our book.
Yes, I agree with you. And of course, so many of our leaders were assassinated. And I think that took the heart out of so many of us. One of the things that you say was common to the leaders that you write about in this wonderful book, By the Light of Burning Dreams, is that they were committed to working both inside and outside the system. Could you talk more about that and maybe talk a bit about Tom Hayden as an example of that?
I think that was the secret of our success, that we had this inside-outside view of how to make change in America. And Tom Hayden, as you say, is a great, I think, symbol or example of this. Tom, of course, was a very central figure, if not the leading figure of the New Left, was, I think, the best writer and strategist produced by the New Left. And he had a real vision of how to take power. And as we were talking about earlier, I just think the left in general has fallen short of that vision. But Tom was very serious about that. And he made alliances. He worked with a number of people across a broad spectrum. And of course, was very much a courageous leader, I think, of the anti-war movement during the Vietnam era. And in fact, was one of the Chicago Eight put on trial for his leadership of the anti-war demonstrations in Chicago, the Democratic Convention, 1968. After that trial, which he survived, many people, Bernadine Dorn, among others, telling him he should go underground because America was becoming fascist. Tom seriously considered that, but decided no, he was going to stay above ground and try to keep pushing the country in the right direction. So he ends up in Berkeley, living in a commune, which was the sort of leading commune of the time in Berkeley on the left, called the Red Family. A number of well-known activists were there, including his lover, Ann Wiles. And Ann talked to me at great length for the book. I also knew Tom before he died. And that was a period of radical feminist searching in Berkeley and throughout the left. And Tom and other white men were considered too well-known, too celebrated, too big for their own britches. And so he was expelled from the Red Family, even though he was involved with Ann Wiles, who was a very active and, she was really a leader of that commune. He then could have disappeared like many people. You know, the anti-war movement was burning out in the early 1970s because of Nixonian repression. because the war kept grinding on and on year after year, despite these huge protests. And so many of the leaders were burned out and leaving the movement. But Tom, to his great credit, after going through kind of a dark night of the soul, having been evicted, rejected, excommunicated from the left, kind of reinvented himself in Los Angeles in the early 1970s. He hooks up famously with the movie star Jane Fonda, who's also very active, but really needed, I think, more support. As she has said, she was kind of out there by herself. She was anorexic. She was kind of a lost soul in many ways, and yet fighting the good fight for GIs against the war. But she and Tom, I think, became a formidable couple. And they, I think, and my book and our book, I think, does this in a way that's never been done before, gives him credit and Jane credit for reviving the anti-war movement in this country, because they decided after the Pentagon Papers was released, and that became a huge story, that middle America had turned against the war and needed to be mobilized. And so they turned away from the new left sort of communities like Berkeley. They went into the heartland. They toured the country with an anti-war campaign, and they mobilized unions, religious groups, farm groups, middle America. And Tom eventually, and Jane, with the Indochina Peace Campaign, ended up cutting off funding, congressional funding to the war, that led to the end of the war in 1975. So I think Tom Hayden and Jane Fonda deserve a lot of credit for their continued anti-war leadership.
Yes. I was part of that anti-war movement, and it always seemed obvious to me that we had a huge impact in ending the war. I mean, as you point out, you know, leadership was crucial here with Tom Hayden and Jane Fonda and others, but they also rode the crest of the wave that had been built by a huge mass anti-war movement. And in fact, I think I recognize the picture on the cover of this wonderful book, By the Light of Burning Dreams. Is that the National MOB? There's all these folks holding up candles. And
Yes. That's a draft card burning demonstration.
Okay, no, that's different. A draft card burning. There was also the national mobilization against the war was a nationwide protest where we all went out by candlelight and.
Yes, I know you too were a part of this movement, part of this history, and it's to your great credit. Whenever I meet someone who took part in this movement in any kind of way, I feel like a solidarity with them, because it's hard to understand what we were doing and how important it was to us as young people. We thought we were changing the country. We were changing the country, just not as to the extent to which we'd hoped. You know, to complete the Tom Hayden story, by the way, after Tom ends the war or helps end the war in Vietnam, he then decides to go into politics. And I think now it's kind of widely accepted. We have AOC, we have Bernie Sanders, as you say, in Washington, and others that we fight for and campaign for. But in those days, the new left was kind of scorned around electoral politics. And so when Tom announced that he was going to run for the U.S. Senate from California in 1975, and the election was in 76 in the Democratic primary, he was widely kind of sneered at by people on the left. But I think that was an important campaign. And he campaigned on the theme of economic democracy, which was socialism, frankly, by any other name. He wanted to nationalize the energy companies. He wanted to, fast track sort of the Green New Deal, solar energy, renewable energy. He wanted to bring corporate sector in general under public control. And that was the theme of his campaign as he ran for Senate in California. So he was running on themes that Bernie Sanders and AOC would make more popular decades later. Again, Tom was way ahead of his time.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with David Talbot. He is a co-author with his sister Margaret Talbot of By the Light of Burning Dreams, The Triumphs and Tragedies of the Second American Revolution. It's about the new left of the 1960s and 70s. So moving to the Black Panther Party, you focus on Bobby Seale. You've already talked a bit about Huey P. Newton. You also talk about Eldridge Cleaver. But Seale, who was co-founder, is really at the heart of this story. You say he also conceived of the dual strategy, community organizing and winning elections. And I think a lot of people just have an image of the Black Panther Party of, you know, gun-toting revolutionaries, but it was a lot more than that. Talk about that Seale, Bobby Seale's strategy.
Yeah, I interviewed Bobby at great length for the book. I find him a fascinating person. And Bobby, again, is one of these guys who now in his 80s, who is still alive. And when I interviewed him a few years ago for the book, he was still very vibrant. He is today. I talked to him on the phone not long ago. And to me, he's a fascinating figure, just like Tom Hayden. His vision, as you say, was to use guns to stand up to the abusive, racist police in Oakland, where they were living at the time. And he and Huey Newton, the co-founder of the Black Panther Party, did it with dramatic flair. They started by confronting cops who were harassing African-American citizens on the streets of Oakland. They did it legally. They'd read all the law. They knew how far away they had to stand from police to witness them, to observe them. The first cop, of course, I write about this incident with great kind of detail because Bobby acted it out for me. The first time they confronted a cop on the streets, it was very dramatic. 12 guys and women, actually, all in the Black Panther uniforms, the black leather jacket, the beret, and so on. They knew that was important, too. They had to look and act disciplined. Made a huge impact on the crowd that gathered around. And, of course, the cop was very angry, and he drove off, but was very freaked out. And here, then the people want to know who the hell were these people who had stood up with guns and to confront this cop, this racist white cop. And Bobby Seale said, ladies and gentlemen, my name is Bobby Seale. I'm the chairman of the Black Panther Party. This is my friend, Minister of Defense, Huey Newton. Tomorrow we're having a meeting at our headquarters on Grove Street and gave the address and so on. So Bobby's vision, his plan, his strategy was to get electrify the community, which he did, by confronting cops, and then to pivot, as you say, and begin to deliver services that were sorely needed in the Black community, like the free breakfast program for kids, and, you know, rental assistance and clothing, you know, handouts and so on. So the Panthers knew that they had to deliver concrete things to their community that weren't being delivered by the government. And they began to do that. And then Bobby, his final part of his vision was to run for office. And he ran for mayor of Oakland in 1973, ran a very good campaign. He lost, but like Tom Hayden, he raised all the important issues. And I think the Black Panthers would have morphed into a very important progressive electoral organization if Bobby Seale had been allowed to go on. But the Panthers were torn apart internally. He had major problems with Huey Newton at that point. Huey had descended into drugs and gangsterism. And the party was under constant violent repression from the FBI and police. And Bobby Seale himself was jailed. Huey Newton spent long times in jail. They probably really just, you know, worked on him mentally in prison. He was put in solitary, Huey Newton, for long periods of time. He was drugged, I believe, in prison. And so God knows what was done to him. But the Huey Newton that came out of prison was not the same Huey Newton that went in. And this was the kind of, I think, severe repression that the Panthers and other groups had to endure.
Yes, you know, I think a lot of people forget just how violent this was. I mean, you know, Fred Hampton was assassinated. George
Jackson, of course, the prison rights advocate.
Yes.
Soledad Brother. They were, yeah, every major, particularly black militant, but others too, The Kennedy brothers, I wrote two books, Brothers and The Devil's Chessboard, that I think placed the blame squarely with the national security apparatus, killed both the Kennedys. Martin Luther King, of course, was assassinated, and I think, and his family felt the same way, that he was assassinated by a government conspiracy, not by a lone, you know, zealot, as the government always claims. So, yes, I think that was policy. Government policy in this country in the 60s was to eliminate people who they deemed threats, whether it was the King, the Kennedy brothers, Fred Hampton, as you say, rising young Black Panther leader in Chicago, drugged the night before by an informant, as the recent film showed, Judas and the Black Messiah, drugged in his bed and shot by a death squad, including Chicago cops, directed by the FBI, in his bed next to his pregnant wife. I mean, it was outrageous. He was only 21. As Ann Wiles said, she went and saw the blood-spattered bedroom the next day, she and Tom Hayden. They were in Chicago at the time. That it, they were killing everyone. That's the way it felt like, killing everyone who was of any threat on the left. And Fred Hampton, 21 years old, murdered in his bed. So, yeah, that was the kind of violent, and it's been forgotten, I think, bloody repression that many of these movements and leaders had to endure.
And let's not forget Malcolm X. I mean, the thing that's so interesting to me is that they really took out the leaders who were beginning to build coalitions among working class people. Fred Hampton with the Young Lords and the Patriot movement in Chicago, which were working class whites. Malcolm X, who was beginning to talk about a working class coalition, Martin Luther King, and of course, Bobby Kennedy, who just by virtue of his position could unite so many people. What do you make of that?
Well, if people want to know more about what I think about the assassinations, they should read my book, The Devil's Chessboard and Brothers, because that was about what the Kennedy brothers were trying to do in this country, bring peace and justice, I think, in a way that had never been done at the federal level, and were assassinated. And basically, I think what JFK was doing in the White House was trying to end the Cold War. And there was a very powerful national security, I think, complex in this country, led at the time by Alan Dulles, who was the CIA director fired by JFK after the Bay of Pigs invasion of Cuba, that debacle. That the CIA had said was going to be an easy accomplishment. Alan Dulles, I believe, in exile, basically, from the government, led, I think, a covert operation against President Kennedy that resulted in his assassination in 1963. And Bobby Kennedy, as I point out in the book, I interviewed every person who was still alive, by the way. This is, you know, 10, 15 years ago. Every person who was close to the Kennedys. And, you know, my books are based on those interviews. I think what Bobby Kennedy was going to do if he'd made it back to the White House was to reopen, as he was telling close advisors, to reopen the investigation into his brother's murder, because he didn't believe the Warren Commission, the official story. He knew that was a whitewash. And he was killed for that reason also. Sirhan Sirhan, you know, who's still in jail years.
Oh, I think he just got released.
Did he just get released? I think he was. The parole board has recommended his release, but Governor Newsom has to sign off on it still. But in any case, he obviously, all the evidence, and I interviewed people who were wrestling for the gun in the Ambassador Hotel at night when Bobby Kennedy was killed, said that there was no way Sirhan Sirhan fired the fatal shot. He was in a hypnotic state. He didn't know what he was doing. The real shooters, I think, were professional killers who shot Bobby from behind, shot him at point blank range in his skull. Sirhan Sirhan was no way positioned to do that. And there were more bullet holes than there were in his gun, Sirhan's gun. So there was lots of evidence to show there's at least one other, if not two other shooters kitchen pantry that night at the Ambassador Hotel in Los Angeles when Bobby was killed. So, you know, this was official policy to kill people and to kill our leaders. And they did it. And they did it very effectively. And that's one reason why our movements were decapitated and, as you say, disillusioned and ultimately defeated, politically defeated.
David Talbot. Stay tuned for more of our conversation about By the Light of Burning Dreams after the break. Don't go away. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Let's get back to my interview with David Talbot, co-author with his sister Margaret Talbot of By the Light of Burning Dreams. Just before the break, we were talking about the assassinations of so many of the leaders of the social movements of the 60s and 70s, especially black leaders, but also the murder of Robert F. Kennedy, who campaigned on a platform of social and economic justice. Now, there was also, as you pointed out, a huge amount of infiltration by spies and provocateurs. You mentioned the American Indian Movement. Let's talk about AIM and the occupation at Wounded Knee. Tell us a little bit more about Dennis Banks and Russell Means and why they decided to do this occupation at Wounded Knee. What were their goals?
Well, Wounded Knee, of course, was a very, I think, spiritual sort of site for the Native American people, and particularly for the Lakota tribe, because almost 100 years earlier, it was the site of a massacre of some 300 Lakota tribes people by the regiment that had formerly been led by George Armstrong Custer. In some ways, it was revenge. This regiment was taking out bloody revenge on a very peaceful tribe that offered no resistance. They butchered men, women, and children, over 300 people, at this site in South Dakota, Wounded Knee. And it was holy ground for the, as I say, Native American people. The American Indian Movement came along at that time in the early 70s, co-founded by Dennis Banks, who was had been inspired by the Black Panthers, had been a convict, had served time in prison, as well as with the Air Force. Russell Means, another tough visionary leader, later hooked up with him. And Russell had been raised in Lakota Territory, and the people appealed to him. The people on this tribe, on this tribal reservation, Pine Ridge, appealed to Russell Means and to Madonna Thunderhawk, another leader of the movement who was Russell's cousin, said, look, we're being run by this guy who's a thug, basically. He got elected under false and corrupt means, Dick Wilson. He was the president of the tribe and Pine Ridge Reservation in the early 70s. He had a squad of people who were armed, going around intimidating all his political opponents, shooting up their homes, beating them up. He was a thug, and he was backed by the federal government. So the people on the tribe appealed to AIM. AIM was known as a rising group within the Native community. It started in Minneapolis, on the streets of Minneapolis, like the Black Panthers, standing up against abusive racist cops who would periodically raid the sort of Indian community and take people away to jail. And then they would be forced to work off their, you know, their so-called crimes. So AIM was known and beloved within the Native American community. People finally felt, here's a group that's standing for our rights. So they appealed to Dennis and to Russell, Madonna Thunderhawk, and they said, come, take a stand with us here at Pine Ridge against the abusive administration and for Indian rights. You know, for years and years and years, one broken treaty after the next with the federal government, you know, exploiting and betraying the Native American people. So they did. In 1973, they took a stand. Men, women, and children, this tiny hamlet on the Pine Ridge Reservation. They were immediately surrounded by federal marshals, by sheriffs, by vigilantes from Dick Wilson's, his goon squad, as they proudly call themselves. They were way outnumbered and way outgunned. there was like a, people later said it was like Vietnam, a battlefield. They were surrounded by armored trucks, by armored personnel carriers from Vietnam. They had technology from Vietnam. Many of the people surrounding them were former Vietnam soldiers. But the Indians who were there under the leadership of Dennis Banks, Madame Thunderhawk, Russell Means, stood their ground for 71 days and withstood over 500,000 rounds of ammunition fired into their tiny little hamlet, a church, a supply store, little sheds where they were living. It was cold. They were cut off from the outside. The kids were starting to suffer from malnutrition. And a guy named Bill Zimmerman, amazing guy, sort of a zealot of the New Left, organized a flight. He was a pilot, among other things. And he flew small planes, Cherokee planes, over the site and dropped food to these starving people at one point and allowed them to continue. They finally, on the final night of the siege, they felt they had made their point. Two Indians had been killed by this gunfire from federal forces. So they knew that Dennis Banks, just like Sitting Bull and Crazy Horse, in the previous century had been killed after being taken into federal custody. They knew that Dennis Banks very well might be killed under false pretenses. He was trying to escape, what they always say, and the feds would gun him down. So that night, he was led out, the last night of the siege, he was led out through this really tight encirclement, armored cars, armored personnel carriers, guns, dogs, snarling dogs, infrared technology from Vietnam. He was led out to safety by Lenny Foster, a young Navajo who had been at the siege, throughout the siege. And a brave young man who I interviewed later. I interviewed Dennis also shortly before he died. And their escape from Wounded Knee, the last night of the siege, I think should be a movie. It's one of the most dramatic, I think, episodes in New Left history. And Dennis lived to fight another day. I interviewed him when he was in his 80s. He had a very full and active life. And he could have been easily killed that night in South Dakota, but he wasn't.
Yeah, David Talbot, it is an incredible story. I was on the edge of my chair as I was reading it in your book, By the Light of Burning Dreams. You mentioned Madonna Thunderhawk, and I forgot to mention how prominent the women were in the Black Panther Party. They were also really prominent in the American Indian Movement. And I think this is another thing that people either don't know or have forgotten. Talk about the role of women in these, supposedly male-dominated macho movements.
Yeah, no, it was very important. It was the women, by the way, at Pine Ridge who lived there, who said, if you, shaming Dennis Banks and Russell Means, if you don't have the guts to take a stand here, we will. So the women, in many ways, were the driving force at Wounded Knee. And Madonna Thunderhawk, as you say, who was a cousin of Russell Means, was, I think, an amazing figure. And I interviewed Madonna for this as well. Madonna led, among other things, the medical aid group that took care of wounded people there at Wounded Knee. And she and another very brave woman would crawl out under fire and bring in wounded people and help patch them up. She was very courageous. And later, she had a very active life as a warrior for her people, going from one sort of protest to the next. I saw her at Standing Rock. She was there at Standing Rock. She continued to be in it. To this day, has continued to be, I believe she's in her 80s now, a very active person for Native American rights. So I think the women don't get their due. It's often, as they say, as Madonna told me, the media likes wanted Indian on a horse, to interview the brave sort of Native American warrior type. And yes, Dennis Banks and Russell Means were both charismatic figures, and I don't discount the importance of that. They're both brave men, very charismatic guys. And the media was very fixated on both of them. And I understand why. But behind the scenes, the women were essential and kept those movements going. And when those men were on the run or in jail, and most of them were most of the time, it was the women who kept things going with alternative schools, with different protests against mining companies and so on, and trying to link the environmental movement with the Native rights movement. And you could see the fruits of their labor at Standing Rock, where I was, many years later.
Yes. So speaking of women, you have a wonderful chapter about the Jane Collective in Chicago, which is newly relevant today as the threat to abortion rights is increasingly acute. Tell us about Heather Booth and what Jane was.
Well, I did the original interview with Heather, but I want to give a shout out to my sister, Margaret, who did the most of the work and wrote that chapter. And I'll tell you why quickly. I had a stroke right as I was preparing to write this book. And I thought that was it. All this great research I'd done, interviews with Dennis Banks, Bobby Seale, Tom Hayden, and so on, would go to waste. But I was able to recover enough to start writing the book. But I knew I would need some help. So I turned to my sister. Fortunately, I had a great writer in my family, Margaret Talbot, who is a staff writer at the New Yorker magazine. And I asked Margaret if she would be willing to collaborate with me to finish the book. And fortunately, she said yes. So I got a great opportunity to work with Margaret on this book. And after I did the original interview with Heather, she stepped in and wrote that chapter on Heather Booth and the Jane Collective in Chicago. But as you say, it's an amazing example of women's resistance and leadership. What Jane was an underground abortion collective in Chicago in the late 60s, early 70s, before abortion was legalized by Roe v. Wade. And these women were mostly at the time, like Heather, student at University of Chicago. She got a phone call, Heather did, from a woman saying she needed help finding assistance to have an abortion. It was illegal at the time, so she didn't know where to go or who to turn to. Heather eventually built the Jane Collective. It was called Jane Collective, by the way, because women were instructed when they called into Heather's dorm to say they were looking for Jane. It all had to be done in a very hush-hush way. So originally they had a African-American doctor who, like Heather herself, had come from Mississippi. Heather had gone down to Mississippi in the Freedom Summer in 1964. That's where she cut her teeth as an activist. This African-American doctor was run out of Mississippi by the Ku Klux Klan, and he was living in Chicago. And he originally provided the abortions very secretly as part of the Jane Collective. But eventually the women themselves trained themselves how to do safe abortions. They charged very little money. It was on a sliding scale. If a woman couldn't afford any money, she gave them whatever she could. It started out mostly for students on campus, but soon spread out, and it was widely being utilized, their services, throughout Chicago by women who needed them. In fact, cops, wives, and girlfriends were among their clients. Finally, they were busted on the eve of Roe v. Wade. They were looking at doing prison time. And then Roe v. Wade, the Supreme Court decision on abortion, legalizing abortion, came to their rescue at the right time. But these were very brave women performing services that were essential. And today, as abortion becomes more and more difficult for women, particularly in Texas and other parts of the country, I think women may have to be put in the same position, and men, in going underground and performing safe abortions, illegally, because the laws become more and more restrictive, as we know, in certain parts of the country.
Yes, and that is just underscores how one can never assume that rights have been won. They always have to be defended. And finally, You make the point, you and your sister Margaret Talbot make the point in By the Light of Burning Dreams, that all these movements saw themselves as interconnected. So I wonder if you could talk about that wider vision. I mean, we haven't talked about the gay rights movement, which is also in the book. We haven't talked about much about Cesar Chavez and the United Farm Workers. Talk about how the leadership of this movement and the movements themselves saw themselves as interconnected.
Well, that's a very important part, as you say, of the book. I'm glad you raised that. You know, as we say right away in the introduction to the book, Martin Luther King had that vision to bring together these people from a wide spectrum of American descent. And he was trying to do that with the Poor People's March in 1968. That march was much more radical than we understand today, because what Martin's goal was to not only stage a protest like he had back in 1963 with the famous I Have a Dream speech, but to occupy Washington, just like the Bonus Army had famously done in the early 1930s. The Bonus Army being disgruntled World War I veterans, and they had occupied the city until Congress acted on their behalf. And that's what Martin wanted to do. He wanted to bring together a broad coalition of people. He called up, or he had Ralph Abernathy, his right-hand person, call up Bobby Seale from the Black Panthers. I was astonished by this. Bobby Seale said Martin Luther King reached out to him and said, "Would you join my Poor People's Coalition and march on Occupy Washington?" And Bobby said, who had heard Martin Luther King speak earlier in Oakland, said he was proud to do that. Yes, he would march with him. So the Black Panthers were going to be involved. American Indians were going to be involved. The United Farm Workers were going to be involved. Martin wanted to occupy Washington and force Congress to divert funding from the Vietnam War to domestic programs. That was a revolutionary tactic and revolutionary goal. And that was what he aimed to do in 1968. I believe that was the final straw. I believe that's why he was assassinated in April of that year in Memphis. Martin Luther King, his final sermon that he was going to deliver at his church in Atlanta before he was killed was "Why America May Go to Hell." He had a very, I think, radical vision of how this country had gone wrong, how we were spending more money killing people than educating people. And his speech, all Americans should read, that he gave his sermon at Riverside Church in New York City 1 year to the day before he was killed in Memphis. Very radical speech in which he's attempting to link together the civil rights movement, the anti-poverty movement, and the anti-war movement. So yes, I think the connections between these groups, and I could talk for days about this, were very important. I think that's what threatened people like J. Edgar Hoover, the head of the FBI, President Johnson, President Nixon. They were threatened most by this coalition, by the idea of all these groups coming together to demand, you know, major reforms in America. And I think that's why they cut down our leaders. And that's why these movements, I think, ultimately fell short of their goals. But I think the strategy of bringing together all these movements is something we still need to do today.
And it seems to me that that is beginning to happen. I mean, the environmental movement, the racial justice movement, the movement for economic democracy, you know, are coming together, not least in the person of the Reverend William Barber, who is really the inheritor in many ways of Martin Luther King and his fight for the beloved community. Do you have some last words for us? You know, we face a terrible assault on the basic, most fundamental parts of our democracy, on voting, you know, climate change. I mean, the crises, you know, the hell that Martin Luther King prophesied does seem to be coming true. Do you see, after writing this book, do you have some final words for us as to, you know, some positive directions that you see that we are going in or can go into?
Well, you know, I just turned 70, But I have children who are much younger, obviously. I have a son who's in his 20s and a son who just is 30, 31. And my oldest son, Joe, made The Last Black Man in San Francisco, which was the, I think, a great film. Everyone should.
Yes. Wonderful film.
Yeah. And it's available now on streaming platform. So The Last Black Man in San Francisco, I was very proud of Joe and Jimmy Fails, who co-starred in that film and was like another son to me, is like another son. Jimmy and Joe collaborated on that film. And to me, that was an example. When I saw Joe win Best Director Award in Sundance for that movie, and when I, then they also got a Best Award for Best a Collaboration on a film. And I saw those young people on stage at Sundance. To me, that was the hope for the future. They're Black, they're brown, they're women, they're men, they're gay, they're straight, they're none of the above. And they're all just piling on stage together because they worked for years on this film. It was a dream of theirs coming out of every community in San Francisco that, you know, San Francisco still struggling to be a diverse city, but you know, that was represented that night on stage at Sundance. So to me, yes, I have kids and I work with people who are younger in politics here in San Francisco where I live. And, you know, to me, they are the hope of the future because they want to live. And frankly, some of them don't know whether they should even bring children into this world because of climate change, because of the ugliness they see all around them. And I can understand their despair, but I also relate to their sense of hope. So what I tell them as a father, you know, is that what we did in the 60s is important. We took care of each other, number one. That's really important. We have to take care of each other. We have to learn to live tribally, not just, you know, for yourself and for your family, but for an extended community. And then you build out from there. Take care of each other, live tribally, and create the world that you want right now. Create it through films, through art, through books, through the way you live your life in your community, and through the service, how you deliver services to each other. You know, we can't depend on Joe Biden. We can't depend on, God knows, Mitch McConnell to deliver the services we need. We need to create that world for ourselves. And that's what the message of the 60s and 70s was. I wrote another book called Season of the Witch, which is about how San Francisco was liberated in the 60s and 70s. And it was done in a very bloody and hard fashion. It wasn't born with flowers in their hair, like the song goes, but howling in blood and strife. That's how San Francisco values, progressive values, were created. So we can do it city by city, community by community. I know we can. We can create the world that we want to live in today.
Wow, those are such powerful words. And thank you for saying them. And thank you for writing this book with your sister, By the Light of Burning Dreams. It's a compulsive read. It's wonderful. And thank you so much for talking with us here.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
David Talbot has worked for Mother Jones Magazine, the San Francisco Examiner, the New Yorker, Rolling Stone, and other publications. He founded the online magazine Salon. Listen to an audio excerpt from By the Light of Burning Dreams by going to writersvoice.net. Next week on Writer's Voice, we talk with A.L. Press about his book, Dirty Work. And vegan champion Melanie Joy tells us about the 10th anniversary edition of her book, Why We Love Dogs, Eat Pigs, and Wear Cows, an introduction to carnism. Let's go out with a trailer to the re-release of FTA. It's a terrific documentary about the 1971 tour of American military bases in Southeast Asia that was made by Jane Fonda, Donald Sutherland, and other anti-war actors and musicians.
Do you have change for a quarter?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah? You always address an officer as sir. Now I'm going to give you one more chance, and I want to hear that sound loud and clear. Private, do you have change for a quarter?
No, sir. I went down to that base. They took one look at my face and read out an order. Barbie!
I said Foxtrot, Tango, Alpha. Free the Army.
I don't believe in this war because nobody wants us. Nobody wants us in there.
I think if I was in a country and I lived here, you know, I'd sort of resent anybody else coming in, putting bases up and everything else.
Good afternoon, Fourth Band. It's a beautiful sunshiny afternoon here on the Mekong River Delta, where elements of the 101st Airborne tangle with a crack North Vietnamese 7th Regiment, both teams undefeated and untied so far this season.
There are apparently several thousand more GIs outside that can't come in, so we're going to do a second show. It may not be able to be the full show because apparently you have to be back in prison by midnight.
They want you to be a little robot. They wind you up and they want you to do the job that you're supposed to do. They don't want you to be an individual.
The service won't let you question because they don't have an answer.
Captain, I have a dream.
I have a dream, a big dream. A dream of democracy.
That's my dream.
Decoded those words, say FTA. But what they mean, hey, no one could guess. Free the Albanians, future teachers of America, who would write that on latrines?
Foxtrot, Tango, Alpha, help me, tell me, what does it mean?
The Army and the Navy and the Marines!
That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Be sure to visit us at writersvoice.net to find out who's coming on next week, listen to archive shows, and leave your comments and suggestions. That's www.writersvoice.net. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.